de lunes a jueves.
The Safari Park.
You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Larry, get into bed now.
Come on, Larry! Larry!
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name buried in cheers and applause? I think not. You know, we all arrive and depart Hotel Earth in the same way, empty-handed. But it's what we acquire along the way that can make a big difference in how much we enjoy the journey. But figuring out what we really, really need can be difficult. We're bombarded by advertising constantly. Corporations and political fronts and religious outfits and charities all telling us what we need to buy and give and believe in. It's like living at the base of Niagara Falls with an unceasing cascade of bullshit raining down upon us. And no matter what they're selling, the message is the same. This thing will make you happy. And sometimes they do. For a while. We get hold of a new set of wheels, and oh yeah, that new car smell and shiny sheet metal and purr of the engine are all pretty satisfying, aren't they? But after a while, after so many miles or months, it gets to be just a way to get from point A to point B. And the carpet stains a little and you pick up a couple of door dings or maybe a squeak somewhere. Or the moonroof makes an annoying clunk when it opens. But at some point, the thrill is gone. And if we think back on all of our material acquisitions, that's pretty much how they run. We're all like kids on a road trip. And we find ourselves somewhere, anywhere, the Grand Canyon or maybe the Eiffel Tower. And what do kids always want? A souvenir. And for a few hours, at most days, we find that tchotchke so necessary. And then one day, we're fishing through a kitchen drawer looking for scotch tape, and holy shit, look at that! My souvenir Eiffel Tower keychain! And we grab the tape and shut the drawer. So are there things we need to get that don't wind up forgotten in a kitchen drawer? Things that can actually bring us lasting happiness? Well, indeed there are. There are three of them. Three keys. And they're really not all that arcane. How do I know them? Well, I neither invented nor discovered them. They were bestowed upon me by a guy I once knew. He called himself the fabulous Don Kane. Was Don super wealthy? No. He was comfortable. Working with Don was like working with Aesop, but he always appeared to be suppressing laughter at some joke, the punchline of which only he could hear. He never once called me Larry, and I never asked him why. It was always Mr. Blydner, and he'd stretch out the S like I just did. I don't ever recall Don without a smile on his face. It wasn't chemically induced or from some religious rapture. Don was a truly rare bird, a happy guy. It was a fairly high-pressure gig where we met. People spent all their times busting their asses to make quotas. And those who couldn't succeed in that manner tried not to just kiss the boss's ass, but to insert their entire heads deep inside that dark cavity. You know the type, the Kool-Aid drinkers. And Don just sat on the sidelines, smiling at those private jokes of his. When I think back on Don, I suspect there rarely was a private joke. He was a good chunk older than the rest of us, old enough to be our dad. And he'd seen this stupid movie before. He was laughing at our lunacy, at a bunch of dogs chasing their tails. The fabulous Don had a raft of axioms and bromides, none of which was the prosaic shit boring assholes have been repeating for eons. Now, I don't know if Don's were all original, but I heard them for the first time from him. Axioms like, there are only so many beach days. Of course, this was in New York, not Southern California, and he was quite right. Some people we worked with disliked Don. Those that did were rigid, humorless, and stupid. They resented Don because he did what they did, and not only made it look easy, he was honest about it. It was simply selling advertising to keep a magazine afloat. It was not a holy calling, not a vocation. There was nothing noble or altruistic or even necessary about it. In fact, it was more than a little bit trifling. I mean, who the hell needs a magazine? Any magazine? It wasn't food or fuel or medicine. It was providing a nice diversion. And now that magazines are nearly extinct, I must wonder if those highly dedicated wonks who thought their careers actually meant something have realized Don was brilliant and they were fools. Probably not. Of course, not only Don and I were in on the joke, there were a few others who knew what time it was, but we were a minority. The true believer, the dyed-in-the-wool corporate man or woman, sees their job not as a means to an end, but an end in itself. They probably most disliked Don because he was happy. And don't the unhappy often revile the happy? But his was not the beatific happiness of some religious zealot or the mindless smiles of the mentally disadvantaged. Don's happiness came from the stone fact that he'd played the game for many years and knew just about every angle and bungee pit and speed bump and blind spot and had a near bottomless well of experience. And so while some of my peers regarded Don as a silly fossil, I saw him not only as a cool dude but a resource of wisdom. And so I sought his counsel on a number of occasions. Perhaps you may be wondering where the hell those three keys are. I'm getting to them. So we'd sit in a big, impressive conference room in one of Manhattan's most prestigious office buildings, high above the madding crowd below. Hands were folded on the exotic wood of that table, hands that sported wristwatches that could feed a family for several years in other parts of the world. Not that there's anything wrong with luxury and fine things, so long as they're held in proper perspective. And we'd sit there listening to an avalanche of bullshit, quarterly projections and cockamamie discount schemes and idiotic ideas for client entertainment, one of which was the vaunted and disastrous opening day at Yankee Stadium. Now, that Yankee Stadium has since been demolished and rebuilt. And it's entirely possible that the neighborhood in which the stadium resides has been gentrified and is now some upscale paradise. But at that time, it was a shithole. This was the South Bronx of Fort Apache fame, a place where even cops dared not walk the street without a companion cop. It was that dangerous. And it was equally depressing. A vista of burned-out tenements, as far as the eye could see. The douchebag politicians of that time tried to camouflage the tenements with an idiotic contrivance. Over every hole where a window had once been, they bolted a piece of sheet metal disguised to look like a window, replete with a fake shade and string pole hanging down. As if those tenements, filled with rats and crackheads and corpses, were actually cozy gingerbread houses in fucking Mayberry, USA. It was insane. And when I heard of this Yankee opening day idea, I almost laughed out loud. I looked across the table at the fabulous Don. The corners of his mouth were turned up. He, too, was suppressing a laugh. I wanted to shout, "Are you people out of your fucking minds? Yankee Stadium? The South Bronx?" Don looked straight at me and sort of brushed a finger past his lips. He did it in such a way that someone else may have thought he was scratching an itch. I knew he was urging me to dummy up. And somehow, the idea picked up steam. Some other hoopoe said the word tailgate party, as if we were talking about some bucolic, safe, grassy, suburban location where the odds of being a crime victim were in the six digits, not the lead pipe cinch it was in the South Bronx. In a few phantasmagoric moments, they had it all art-directed. They'd rent some vintage collectible Ford Country Squires with faux woody side panels. They'd have Ralph Lauren table settings. They'd have the publisher's personal chef barbecue ribs and burgers and dogs. They'd make custom embroidered baseball caps for the event. It was going to be so much fun! Everyone was commanded to get at least one or two key clients and take them out to the ballpark. The big day finally arrived, and the non-native New Yorker who was the author of this idiotic and dangerous outing had two Ford Country Squires parked across from the house that Ruth built. In a cinder and broken glass-filled parking lot that was under some type of rusting steel overpass, and if you weren't getting splattered by pigeon shit, rusty bolts big enough to crack your skull were falling from the roadbed above every time an 18-wheeler would rumble by. It wasn't a place for a tailgate party. It was a place where winos and junkies might congregate until they could find somewhere more comfortable. People stood around and nervously eating and drinking designer imported beer and dodging the pigeon shit and the falling debris. Most were clearly uneasy, but that airhead believed that if she just high-fived enough and said, "This is so much fun!" and carried on her charade of forced gaiety, everything would just be all right. Then it was game time, and I assumed that since this was a special outing, a schmooze fest for blue-chip clients, that our seats would be fantastic behind home plate or the dugout, something top shelf and spectacular, because that's the way things were usually done at that company. My client was a very elegant woman who ran one of New York's most prestigious jewelry retailers. She was accustomed to limos and mock seats. And as we walk in the stadium, I hand my tickets to an usher. He looks at them and points to the sky. I was incredulous. I told him to check again. Nope. Our seats were in the fucking nosebleeds. To quote the great Mickey Spillane, getting to that altitude was like climbing Everest on roller skates. Up and up and up we went until I thought my hamstrings would snap. Finally, we were just a few rows from the arc lights on the very rim of the stadium. Nearby was the dopey broad whose idea this idiocy had been. By the top of the third inning, there were three fistfights in progress no more than 20 feet from us. One was a mere two rows behind us and gaining kinetic energy and combatants by the second. Think of a wave that's actually a fistfight. It was simply a matter of time until the fight wave would envelop us. The starry-eyed idiot was still determined to smile it out. I looked back at her to see a stray fist from behind strike a glancing blow across the top of her head, sending her reeling as she screams, "Oh my God, oh my God!" I turn to my client and say, "Diana, I'm pals with the maitre d' at the best French restaurant in town. Are you hungry?" She stood, took my arm, and we stepped into the aisle. At that instant, we heard a horrible thud and crack. And there, in Diana's seat that she had vacated seconds ago, lay a body, on its back, unconscious and folded over the seat. The crack may have been the sound of his spine breaking as he hit that seat back. No human could be that flexible. The guy was broken like a matchstick. Two rows above, some caveman shook his fist at the unconscious body and growled, "And fuck your team, you Pittsburgh piece of shit!" We ran out of there and onto the street. It was nearly dark. No cabs. I saw a stretch limo and rapped on the window. He buzzed it down. I showed him a portrait of Grant and said, "Hey, run us to Midtown and you'll be back here before the seventh inning stretch." The guy looks at me and says, lay another 20 on air, we're good. Okay, done. We hopped in and got the fuck out of hell. Soon we were washing down sautéed crab with nice Chardonnay in a cozy, elegant bistro. The next day at the office, we learned one of our colleagues was mugged at knife point while trying to get a cab.
So much fun!
Which brings me to the first of Fabulous Don's three keys to happiness, which is a job you like. But you really have to break this one down into two parts. Part one, a job, yes. Unless you've got a hefty trust fund, having some Skrilla flowing really is the first leg of that piano stool of happiness. The tricky part comes in the second half. You like. This is not easy. How many of us just grind out whatever the fuck we're doing simply to cover the rent and fill the fridge? Sadly, many of us do. Often we barely tolerate our jobs. Yet, as the months and years fly by, we find ourselves more deeply entrenched in an industry or endeavor we loathe because we did it for the bread, not for the bliss. Now, all of Don's three master keys do have sub-keys, and the one that fits this lock is the old axiom, do what you love and the money will come. Well, what about that guy who would love to be a shepherd, or center for the Lakers, but he's only 5'7". Problematic, yes. In fact, I'd love to stand in for Keith or Slash, but those positions are already filled, and I don't have the chops anyway. There's no easy answer to this one. But people who take career paths strictly for the money always regret it and usually die young. My kid's pediatrician is pushing 90. He sure doesn't need the money. But he loves helping sick kids. He found his bliss and got wealthy. I also knew a doctor who blew his head off in his 30s. Just hated what he did. Not everyone finds their bliss. But we sure as hell know our own pain tolerance. And if your job makes you miserable, there's your answer. Some people just run from a job they hate and take anything and find the next stop is perfect. The point is to keep moving. Don't accept suffering as the norm. It does not have to be that way. And so on to the second key in the Fabulous Don's Troika. Key number two, a nice place to live. This can also be a bitch and is, of course, directly related to the first key. Without sufficient Skrilla, we won't have much choice. We'll be stuck in a shithole. Sometimes, you might be in very nice accommodations and have your dream domicile turned into a living hell by some scumbag neighbor, as I did. I loved where I lived, until a dentist moved in next door, along with his wife and kids and three dogs. Seems dentists piss me off, like the one who almost killed me in episode 11. This guy's dogs were the problem. This scumbag would leave them outside day and night. In the day, in summer, 110 degrees were common, and these dopey mutts would kick over their water dish early on and suffer in thirst until either shit for brains or his bleeding hemorrhoid ugly-ass wife came home from her job. I like dogs, and this dentist shitbag was surely abusing them, albeit in a passive manner. But what really lit my fuse was when these mutts would start barking at 2 a.m. I asked this douchebag fuckface asshat nicely to keep his dogs quiet at night. When I did, he said he would try in a dismissive manner. And I said, try isn't good enough. Keep it quiet. And then he says very sarcastically, I'll do the best I can. That's when I got right in his grill and said, fuck you. I'm from the Robert Frost School of Neighborliness. Good fences make good neighbors. I really don't want to know mine, because if I could, I'd live in the middle of 50,000 fucking acres where there would be no neighbors. And so the dogs kept barking, and I was losing sleep, and it was affecting my job performance and my ability to make the money that enabled me to live in the house that I liked very, very much. and I was not about to move because of Dentist Boy and his dogs. So I called Tony Spumante, laid out the problem for him. "How close can you get to those dogs?" he asked me. I described the layout. "Lob a couple of meatballs full of ground glass over there. Your troubles are over." I wanted to make Dentist Boy eat the meatball with the ground glass, not his dogs. Next, I talked to an attorney I knew. He told me the city of Los Angeles took a real dim view of noise pollution. So I shot a shitload of time-stamped video of his mutts yapping in the middle of the night, and of them with their tongues hanging out in midday with flipped-over water bowls in a yard covered with piles of dog shit. Oh yeah, Dentist Boy was a fucking pig, and every day he was putting his hands in people's mouths. Anyways, I get a hold of animal control, and a hearing was set. It was in a typical gloomy cinder block room with those plastic chairs with an oval hole in the back, the ones that look as if they might double as some kind of field toilet. Who designs those chairs? In walks some guy in a khaki uniform with stripes on his sleeve. Who knew animal control was paramilitary? But he's also wearing a doggy-themed necktie and lapel pins, and I'm thinking, oh, great, this guy probably thinks barking dogs are music. 10 minutes go by of silence, and shithead dentist is nowhere in sight. I'm hoping maybe he died in a fiery car wreck on his way over. The guy in uniform says, "Let's see what you got," and I turn on the video. He didn't seem too perturbed by the night vision barking footage, but when he saw the shit-strewn yard and the overturned water dishes and the three thirsty mutts, he turned purple. That's when Dentist Boy walks in, holding a little construction paper book with some snapshots in it. Looks like a second-grade class project. And he starts paging through it, and after three pages, the uniform guy says, "That's enough." And then he opens a manila folder. And he says to Dentist Boy, "You have three dogs, correct?"
"Yes, sir,"
says Dentist Boy. "Then why is only one of them licensed?" "Mr. Blydner has shown evidence that not only are your dogs creating a nuisance, your treatment of them appears to be abusive. I'm fining you now for the unlicensed dogs. You have 30 days to quiet them. If at the end of that time Mr. Blydner complains again, you will then have two options. We shall either cut their vocal cords or take them from you. Your choice. Oh, and you'll be paying for the surgery if it's choice number one." I never heard his dogs bark again. So a man or woman's home is their castle, and if yours is unlivable, it's damn hard to be happy. That's the second key, and whether it's a two-man tent in the woods or some 30,000-square-foot Bel Air mansion, it's your second essential key to a good life. And number three on Don's list is the most obvious and perhaps the most elusive. A nice love life. The fabulous Don would often talk about his wife, and never in the pejorative way many guys do. I don't recall how many years they were married, but it was a hell of a lot. And so I picked up another nugget of wisdom from Don one evening over drinks at a nearby bar. There was another co-worker there who was recently engaged, but clearly still not sure if she was the one. And so Don asked him a few questions. How long had he known the girl, and why he wanted to marry her, and so on. And then Don says, "Have you ever heard of the jelly bean corollary?" We had not. And the fabulous Don went on to ask him if his girlfriend was sexy, and the guy says, "Well, of course." Then Don continues to say that in many cases, if you were to keep a big jar somewhere, and each time you and your girlfriend knocked boots before marriage, you put a jelly bean into that jar, it would probably be filled to overflowing. However, Don continued, if after marriage you were to remove a jelly bean each time, you would both likely die with jelly beans left in that jar. I could see the guy was crestfallen. And then Don says, so the lesson of the jelly bean corollary is, you and your fiancé better have something to talk about. The guy just stared at Don. I couldn't tell if he'd bought into the jelly bean corollary or not. A few months later, the guy got married. About a year after that, he got divorced. You know, so many times when I'm ready to hammer the lid shut on a new episode, my email tings and there's a comment or a question from a listener. And that question is so timely, it's truly serendipitous. And so this question comes from a guy named Dustin. No, not Facebook Dustin from the Dick Show. This guy's on the West Coast, and his question is a very common one. How do you know when you've met the right girl? Oh, Dustin, this is such a toughie. But here's some thoughts that may help you sort things out that actually relates to Don's jelly bean corollary. Many guys are attracted to the different, the exotic, the mystery of a chick. But over time, it's not your differences that will hold you together, but your similarities. Over time, even the pointiest of chicks round off a bit. Have you ever been someplace, at work or a party or dinner with people you know but not all that well, and maybe you find these people boring or annoying or just all-purpose assholes, as Tony would say, and you look to your girlfriend or fiancé or, God forbid, wife, and you want her to commiserate and squeeze your hand or give you that look that says, I'm on your wavelength. But instead of that affirmation of your feelings, you get a questioning look. Maybe she sees nothing wrong with these assholes, or even seems to fit right in with them. If so, that's a bad match. And the two of you, though technically a couple, will always feel alone, even when with one another. Shortly after I met my wife, a mutual friend said to me, you two are made for each other. You see with one eye and hear with one ear. That's probably the single most important way to evaluate any potential mate, Dustin. And if you're not getting that solitary eye and ear thing from the start, you never will. Hey, thanks for hanging with me again at the dojo. Lots of cool things coming up. We'll soon have the climactic third and final installment of the epic tale of payback, Vengeance is Ours. Did we demolish the loathsome Tommy as we had promised? Well, slide over to patreon.com/thatlarryshow and join the dojo to find out. You won't be disappointed. Need some help? We may have a sensei here who can fix what ails you. Drop us a line at thatlarryshow@gmail.com or call us at 302-71-LARRY. Follow us on Twitter at thatlarryshow. Especially follow us on Twitter, where it appears some type of violent confrontation may be brewing between yours truly and the rage-filled Dick Masterson. Should be fun. Stay tuned. And so, my friends, to look at it in the broader sense, everything we own is a souvenir picked up on our journey of life. Whether an Eiffel Tower keychain or a 400-foot mega-yacht, they're today's trinkets and tomorrow's landfill. Make sure you get the stuff that really matters. We'll see you next Tuesday, right here at the crossroads of madness and enlightenment. And until that time, take no shit.